Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Fran Lewis, and this is Literary Viewpoints. And this is going to be quite exciting. We have author Stephen Shortley here, and we're going to talk about Enemy in the Heartland. Hatred drives 13 college friends to conceive the ultimate act of revenge. Ooh. The diabolical plan grows and festers over a dozen years, targeting thousands of innocent Americans in the nation's heartland, including the president himself. Wait until you hear what happens. Well, we're not going to tell you everything because you got to read the book. Otherwise, what's the point? And hi, Stephen. How are you?
Hi, Fran. I'm up and at it. It's 7 o'clock out here in the desert.
I didn't realize that it was so early. I assume everybody's Eastern time. What can I say? I've been up since four reading.
Well, I almost messed up. I had put down the time at 7 p.m. instead of a.m. And then yesterday I was looking at my notes. I'm going, oops. So the doggies had to go on their two-mile walk early this morning.
Oh, my God. Usually I'm walking, but when I have a show, I don't want to disappear and not get back on time. No. So it's beautiful outside. The sun is shining. The rain finally went away. And it's finally my kind of weather, 50 degrees and 60, not 90. And I'm looking at the prologue. How did you decide to start the book off this way, in this particular way, with this prologue?
Well, you know, it started out, the book and the prologue and everything started out as an accident because I had no incentive to write, and I didn't start writing until after I had a stroke on July 7th, 2013, and 4 months later, I got laid off from my job. I worked for a company up in Connecticut as a regional sales manager. And long story short, in November, things got slow. And so they said, well, we're going to let you go. And my wife, who's a behavioral analyst and a psychologist, she says, you know, you're 63 years of age. Why don't you start writing those books you always have had in your head? So, you know, I sat down and started writing. So the prologue was, you know, part of an idea I had in a book. I'm an old Tom Clancy fan or a Clyde Plessler fan, and it just started to come out in my mind. I don't know where it came from. So,
well, I met Clyde Plessler at the Thriller Fest because they invited me as their favorite book reviewer. I was very lucky. And he's an experience. He's a riot. And I had the honor of meeting Steve Berry and all of them, and I'm really excited because on November 3rd, I'm going to have the honor of interviewing Catherine Coulter on my show. I was like, oh, my God, you have to come to the Thriller Fest. It's a lot of fun. And the authors that are there that you just mentioned and everything, they are really great people. So this book has, and I was good, I don't normally have to get my characters, I'm an educator and a reading specialist and a writing person. So I've got graphic organizers all over the place. So when I went through, I was so happy that you had a character analysis in the front of the book, so I was able to follow along a lot easier. So how did you decide on the plot line? And why are most novels such as this one focused on attacks in New York City?
Well, you know, the book started out with a premise and a couple premises. One was, you know, I wanted to make it relevant. You know, I didn't want people to have to really, you know, really struggle to visualize what was going on in the book, even though there's a lot of characters. So I start, you know, when I was recovering from my stroke, you know, I was thinking about, you know, everything I saw on TV and, you know, for the last 7 to 10 years, everything's been terrorism, terrorism, terrorism. So I'm going, okay, you know, that will work for me. And I remember when 9/11 happened because I was stuck in Billings, Montana, Hampton Inn, you know, and my wife called me up that morning, you know, to tell me what was going on. So, you know, everybody's familiar with terrorism and, you know, the attacks, you know, New York or Boston, the big cities on the East Coast seem to be the, you know, the target center. So when I started to write the book, I started to think, okay, if I was a terrorist, who would I want to go after? I mean, what would be an easy target? And since there's so much security in those two cities, I'm going, why don't I do something different? Why don't I attack something or some place where people would never expect it? And so I'm from the Midwest, so, you know, people from the Midwest, like Missouri or Iowa, those states in the Midwest, they think they're impervious because they're so far away, you know, from the Middle East or, you know, foreign countries. And, you know, nobody ever expects to be tactful while they're eating apple pie and watching, you know, Little League baseball games. So that's where I made the target.
That's interesting. So who would you say, this is a tough one, there are like, I think, I didn't count, about 50 or 60 characters in this book. I've got them straight, too. And you have different corporations and different, you have new millennia holdings. You've got U.S. Incorporated, let me put my glasses on, that would help, Titan Construction. And you've got an Israeli intelligence, I love them, and Bizet Jets and everything. How did you decide on the different areas and the different characters in the book? And who would you say are the main characters, if any?
Good questions. Well, one of the things I wanted to do is, like I mentioned earlier, I was a, you know, Clancy fan or, you know, Clive Buster fan, is, you know, there's got to be a diversity of themes running in the book. You know, not really super complex, but you got to keep people guessing. So I based the book on the premise of the old adage, 6 degrees of separation. Somebody knows somebody somewhere. You know, and, you know, over, for example, my wife, yeah, she knows the, some people in the embassy in China. I mean, who would have thought, because my wife's from South Africa. So, I mean, you know, that diversity of, you know, somebody knows somebody somewhere. So, you know, I took that into account. And, you know, the other thing I did was I made a bunch of different entities, you know, corporations and you know, spy groups, you know, like the FBI or the CIA or the Mossad. And, you know, how do they work together? You know, because there's a thing called Interpol. You know, they're kind of like a global, you know, sharing of information, you know, for the police. So, you know, as I started to sit down and think about it, you know, I would just let my mind wander. And you were asking about characters. For me, it was easier to think about, like, you know, who did I work for in the past? My old bosses or college friends or, you know, customers or people I dated. Because it was easier for me to visualize that person and then describe them and their characteristics. So I was just copying everybody in my mind. And then the other thing that I would do is I used to travel 45 weeks a year. So I've been all over the United States, and I used to work for a couple of European companies, one in Italy and one in Germany. So I was fortunate enough to go over there. So, you know, I knew in my head, okay, if I was going to do this worldwide plot, well, let's go to places where I'm familiar with. So, you know, I would go back with Google Earth and zoom in on places I used to go to. And I'm going, okay, we're going to have a attack scene here, or they're going to be in a restaurant there. And for me to pick out a restaurant, say in Berlin, there's a scene in the book where the bad guys get together in Berlin where they're, you know, they're meeting their financiers. I just Googled 5-star restaurants in Berlin, and up on the screen came all these restaurants. So I would just pick one and then describe the interior, their cuisine and stuff. And so, you know, I was more of a describer than, you know, coming up with original ideas.
That's interesting. But why did these 13 friends decide to create a network that would be hidden in plain sight and destroy America? That was really clever. I mean, they were right there, and then they took over a company, and they took over Titan Corporation, and they didn't even realize it until it was too late. What happened?
Well, you know, if you think about the attacks, like the World Trade Center, they just didn't get up one morning and the next day they came to the United States and attack. You know, that took them, you know, a long time, because the pilots that crashed into the World Trade Center, they were trained right here in Phoenix at the flight school about 10 miles from my house. So
that's scary.
You know, So, I mean, what people don't realize is, you know, a lot of these attacks, you know, are calculated and, you know, they're well-financed. And so what I did was, you know, I went to school, and I can remember, you know, back, and I'm dating myself because it was back in Minneapolis during the late 60s. I can remember the first political, you know, staging the kid, you know, college kids did on campus to protest Vietnam. And that always kind of stuck in my head because, you know, University of Minnesota at the time was like 55,000 kids. And here was 2,000. I'm out there yelling and screaming. I'm going, what's going on? You know, it kind of opened up my eyes. So what I did was I picked a university in England. It was called Durham University. And what I did was have these kids who never knew each other until they went to college kind of hang out and get to know each other. And some were from the Middle East. And three or four of them were from Germany. And the ones from Germany, their grandfather was a rich munitions tycoon. He owned a, you know, arms factory, and the premises, you know, whenever there's chaos or war in the world, they sell more guns and bullets. So, sure, I'll covertly fund you kids to go do this stuff. So there was the money. And then the kids going to college, they got educated, you know, and chemistry and all these other things. And so, you know, they were not dummies. And so they've, you know, all lost friends, the ones from the Middle East during the wars, you know, Desert Storm and all these different, you know, war encounters. You know, they lost relatives. And so, you know, when somebody loses somebody, you know, because of war, there's kind of like they want to get revenge or there's anger. So that kind of generated into this plot. And so over 13 years, they slowly figured out how they were going to, you know, attack the United States. And they were really cold and calculating in the way they did it.
And they did it in a very clever way. So how did you create a takeover, leaving the owners of the company as figureheads and they had no clue what happened? So to give me the history of Titan Construction Company that you made up. That was really clever. I said, oh, my God. They were really blindsided.
Well, I sold to the construction industry. I was, you know, when I first got out of college, one of the first jobs I had was I sold blueprinting equipment to engineering companies, design companies, construction companies. So, you know, I had some familiarity with those type of companies. And as I got older, I realized, you know, successful companies, the first generation of leadership, usually get to a point one day where they get bought out or they want to retire with a golden parachute, and somebody comes along and gives them enough money and they take the jump. So the terrorists were looking for some type of cover to go inside. Yeah, because the book is kind of divided in two parts. There's an attack on the United States in the Midwest, and then there's another attack targeting the President of the United States. And so the construction company was just finishing building a multi-story building in St. Louis. And because of political connections of the people who financed the building, the President of the United States was going to inaugurate the building. So the terrorists bought the company that built the building so they can go inside and booby-trap the building before the prisoner came in. So that's how, you know, the Titan Construction Company came to being in the book.
Well, I don't want to give away too much plot, but there are several characters. Which characters would you like to enlighten our listeners about? So I've got Fawaz Kamani, and his father was worried about him. And Saeed Mohammed, because even though he was Muslim, didn't think the way other people did, and he wasn't happy about what was going to happen. So what about these two?
Well, you know, the storyline kind of starts out where there's a mullah over in the Middle East, and he grew up in a small community as a kid. And years later, when he got into his 60s, he was in one of the downtown, you know, little village open-air markets, and he bounced into a friend of his he hadn't seen since grade school or high school. And so one night they got together and to talk about old tales and you know, the history between them and, you know, what happened since they've seen each other. And during the conversation, you know, this one man said to the mullah, he says, you know, hey, now I've got a grandson that I'm really, really, really worried about because he's smart, he went to college, and all of a sudden I think he's got tied up in a bad crowd. And I know you're well connected, you know, because the mullah was kind of like, Yeah, he knew everybody, and mm-hmm. so this guy asked him for help. You know, could you find out, you know, where my son went? And, you know, so, like I said, the Moho was really well connected. So he knew everybody, and he happened to know a Mossad agent who he befriended because he knew that the Mossad guy was, you know, really a good person and not trying to, you know, go out and do devious deeds. Mm-hmm. And so he got a hold of this guy, and he said, hey, you know, could you check out my friend's grandson? And the Mullah was getting a picture of the grandson, so he gave that to the Mossad agent. And that's how they start finding out that something really big and bad was going down the world without giving away the entire plot there. But that's how it started.
Well, there are two other characters that are very interesting, Boz Gazelle and Tina Roberts. And why did she go along with everything that he wanted? Women, sometimes
Baz,
they don't think.
Baz and Tina met in college. They were part of the 13. And
yeah.
Tina, her grandfather was the man that had the munitions factory. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was kind of like love at first sight in a chemistry class. And, you know, I can attest that when I went to college, I fell in love many, many times and never ran into the right one. But these two hit it off, and they got connected with the kids from the Middle East. And, you know, when you're rich and young and you're immortal, you start looking for thrills. And by hook or crook, they got connected with the terrorist. And, you know, Tina and Baz were really, really smart. And, I wrote it so that they were in it for the thrills, but, you know, they also, you know, the closer to the edge they got, the more in love they fell into.
Yeah, well, I saw what you did at the ending. That was pretty clever, too.
Well, thank you.
I was like, oh, okay. And which leads us into the fact that there's going to be another book. I know that. I know there's going to be
a second
book.
Second book is going to be released as soon as I can get the people to finish formatting it and do the final revision of the cover. So the second book is even better from what I've been told.
Well, I'll let you know that. That's my thing.
you'll be getting a copy. You'll be getting a copy.
I'm sure. Just add it to my pile of 90 inside. I've been staring at books, and, you know, yours is long, but you had a plus sign here. The print wasn't small. And when the print is larger than one font or two, and I've been getting books from one font, two, I just toss them aside and I won't even read them. I can't read on my computer, and I will not read anything that where the font is so small that I need a magnifying glass. So this is good.
Well,
and
it was funny that you mentioned that, because when I first wrote the book, it was 367 pages in a Word document, and then
it's long.
And then the guy that edited the book, his name is Ken Jensen. He's the XPR director for Boeing Helicopter over here in Mesa, Arizona, where they make the Apache helicopter. You know, it took me 2 months to find him as an editor. I mean, writing the book took me 4 months, but it took me 9 months after that to get it to market because I didn't have anything set up. I had to go get an editor, a proofreader, and things like this. But, writing the book was the simple part. And I'll tell everybody, if you get it there, you know, good luck, because you're competing with 5,000 new books a day being published.
This is very true. And I've read more than that many books in the last 3 years, seriously. The other plus sign, seriously, people, is I'm a speed reader, thanks to my mother. While I'm going to school, I had 90 hours of homework, but my mother would make me read at least a book a day, maybe more. She was really into this. So when my eyes are not bugging out, which happens at times, I could read 3 books in one day. And you were lucky because I took my time with yours, but if it takes me more than 2 days to read a book, you're in trouble, seriously, which means that the plot doesn't interest poor Fran, and she's going to have to, and I never pan a book, ever. So if I don't like a book, I just write a summary, and I just say, oh, well, what could I tell you?
Well, what happened was when I got done writing the book, we got the book down to like 345 pages, and I'm going, well, you know, I was hoping for something thick. Well, a funny thing happened. There's a lady by the name of Vicki Mullins. I call her my shepherd, my book shepherd. Mm. And she has a company that helps people take their ideas and finally get them into a book.
Mm.
And so she formatted the book the first time, and it was kind of interesting because she said, okay, who are your three favorite authors? So I, told her, and she said, well, give me a copy of the book, and we'll look at it, and I'll format your book like one of those guys. And so we did a Clive Cussler book. Well, when she formatted the book, it turned out to be like 580 pages, and I about died because, I'm not buying 10,000 books at a time. Yeah, it was too long. So she had to reformat it a second time, and we got it down to 430 pages, which is still expensive.
A lot, yeah.
But it's a good looking book, and the sequel, and I'll give you the name of the sequel, is called Revenged Unleashed. If that will give you an idea what happened.
That's a good title.
It kind of leads on. Well, I'll tell you the name of the third book I've already started, because this will even get thrown even more. It's called Homegrown: The Unexpected Terror. Because what are you seeing nowadays? Back in but when I first started to write the first book, you saw drones all the time, and now on TV, all the media's talking about homegrown terrorism. So I'm just, I'm just sitting back and watching TV and taking notes and writing, 5 or 6 hours a day.
It's really too bad that we can't live in a world without terrorism, and that no one wants to get along with anybody, and everybody wants to be superior to everyone. That's the sad part. And that we teach our kids the same thing sometimes, which is really even worse. So who is the brain behind the operation? There's Martin Jones, Dominique, Esteban, Michael, and Barnabas. But who is the real brains behind this thing, and how does this guy get everybody to do all this stuff without anybody shooting off his head?
Yeah, I call them the 3 M's, the 5 J's or 6 J's, because they're all, Johnsons and things. Those guys were related from the Middle East. They went to, and they were the upper class kids at college. I mean, they came from money too. I know it sounds funny, but there's a lot of oil out there in the Middle East, and these kids had a lot of money behind them. So, Martin was really the brains, of the group, and they were younger guys. I mean, by the time the attack hit, they were in their 30s, and I remember when I was in my 30s, I didn't get married till I was 31 for the first time, and I still felt pretty invincible. And so these guys, when they came to the United States, they had it well sorted out. Some of their friends helped them buy the construction company, Titan Construction, and they already had their plan in their minds when they got here. Once they got here, they just had to side things out to make sure their plan was going to work. And once they realized it was, they just needed to get the weapons to carry out the plan. And so that's where Kena and Baz came into effect, because the delivery system for the other part of the attack on the United States was a set of drones, and the drones carried poison gas from a pharmaceutical company they bought to make poison gas. So there you go.
Yeah, that is scary too, poison gas. So there was a team that, of course, was going to try to get these guys. And who are the members of the Archangel team? And tell the listeners, where am I? The next page of my questions right here. It's a good thing I type, because forget it. You've got Brett Hunter. And why did these men fool him for a while? And who are the members of the Archangel team that tried? And which agencies were working together to try to get these guys? And how?
Okay, Brett Hunter was basically a foreman that worked for Titan Construction, and he was finishing off by the time the bad guys get to St. Louis. They were finishing off the multi-story building that the president was going to inaugurate. And so now that there was new ownership in Titan Construction, Brad had no history with the bad guys, and, you know, you don't think bad guys are going to buy a company, so you just kind of treat them like, okay, these are my new bosses, you know, kind of do what you said, you know, they want you to do. And so he had no idea that the building that he just made, a multi-million dollar building, was going to be a trap for the president. But,
nobody vets these people.
That's right. And
yeah,
so,
nobody vets these people. That's scary.
Yeah, you know, and the owners of the company, the previous owners, you know, two of them gone, yippee, you know, were multi-billionaires, golf and martinis for the rest of my life, except for one of them. He was, you know, he was bored. He didn't want to go out and retire, so he kind of stayed on board just to kind of help things, you know, the migration of the old management to the new management. And he was the one that kind of got to, at the end, the idea is that, the new owners aren't really, really nice.
And it takes time before they even realize that. Usually, well, I imagine somebody offers you the money, they want to buy your company, it would be wise to find out who they are, but I guess sometimes they just want to sell the company. Like you said, they wanted to retire. So we've got the New York Police and Fire Department, got the Layton, Utah Police Department, got Campbell Army Field. We've got an awful lot of agencies. So how did these people intertwine or work together so that they would actually communicate and not, you know, one-up each other?
Well, what happened was you got to go back to the year 1972 in real life. And
okay.
Do you remember in 1972? Well, I got to apologize. I don't know how old you are. I'm an old fart.
Younger than most people think, but who knows?
But anyway, back in 72, there was the Olympics in Germany. And during the Olympics, a bunch of terrorists shot a bunch of athletes.
I remember.
And,
yeah.
Okay. So the premise,
I read.
And this is what, yeah, they even had TV back then. But
I don't know.
The reason why I mentioned that is that I went out on a limb with a premise, and after watching TV, you know, now that I'm retired, I think it's a pretty good premise. But I really feel future wars, big wars, are not going to be between countries anymore. They're going to be between countries and terrorist groups.
Yeah.
That's where the future war is going to be. So the premise was, after 1972 and the Olympics having been attacked, the world's, you know, larger nations, their intelligence agencies all got together, and they made a kind of like an Interpol organization, but this was more for intelligence instead of police work. Excuse me. And what better name to call it than the Olympia Committee. So the Archangel team that you're talking about was a tactical assault team, a multi-nation team that were members of this Olympia Committee, because sometimes, you know, the bad guys, you know, are out there and they're ready to do something and somebody's got to stop them. And this intelligence organization, being multinational, they gathered intel from all over the place, and they kind of got together and they start chasing down the bad guys. And, you know, it's kind of hard for one country, even though, say, for example, the United States has got 17 different intelligence organizations, you know, operating out of the United States. You know, it's kind of hard for everybody to know what's going on. So getting back to the beginning of the book, the Mossad agent that we were talking about earlier, he went to one of these Olympia committees because he was, you know, a special agent for the Mossad. And by hook or crook, there was a bombing in New York that you were talking about earlier. And so, you know, everybody was going to that. Must have been terrorism. So the Olympia Committee had a meeting, and they were all kind of sitting around the table, a bunch of these guys, and they all had their laptops up. And the Mossad agent had a picture of this kid that he was supposed to check out up on his screen, and then his buddy next to him had a picture of a security camera footage of the guy that set the bomb in New York. And One guy looked over at his screen, and the other guy looked over at his screen and going, hey, that's the same guy. You know, here comes that 6 degrees of separation. All of a sudden, these two guys from all over the world started looking at their computer screens going, ha, there's the culprit. And they're going, that's too weird to be a coincidence. And so
that's how they start. I've read, like, a lot of books on terrorism, as everybody knows. I've read so many. And the last one that I read was really scary, because here you have a team of people working to catch these guys, and within that team you have a mole. That's what's even more scary. And I don't know. What would happen? I mean, in this particular book, I won't say which one it is, that they had this plan to kill a Pakistani prime minister and another military person. And within the group that was supposed to go after this person, they had a mole. And until they realized what happened and who he was, it was, like, really scary. So could there, I mean, that could really happen, couldn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if you think of it, it can happen, is my premise. You know,
yeah, I know. That's scary.
I mean, my wife, yeah, it's kind of fun to live with, you know, besides being a pretty lady, she's really, really smart, one of the smartest people I know, and being a psychologist, you know, she and I will see something on the news or something, and she's always saying there's a thin line between being, you know, brilliant and psychotic.
That's true.
Because some of these people are just so smart, they just flip out, and people around them, you know, are too busy doing their own thing to really catch these people half the time.
I see what you're saying.
That's where the old saying comes in. You know, hindsight is 20/20.
It's scary, you know, because there are people that are, you know, as an educator, I mean, I work with children with learning disabilities, but I had teachers that work with kids that were really, really, really bright or really not. And sometimes working with children with learning disabilities, I loved it, you know, helping them and getting them up to grade level and stuff. And then there are people that can't deal with people that aren't smart. And then there are people are too smart.
Well, I went to college. You know, I was a 5-year student. Wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do when I first went to college, but figured it out later. But I had three or four friends of mine that were so smart, they dropped out of school. They got bored with college. It was too smart. You know,
I wasn't bored. My mother made me graduate in 3 years. Wow. No, I graduated college in 3 years because my mother, Ruthie, made me go to, I didn't have to go to summer school, but she said advancement is good because your summers are going to be taken up in school or work. There was no vacation, ever. So I graduated college in 3 years, and then I went back later on for 4 master's degrees because my mother said, this is what you're going to do. Seriously. And you have to have the drive in you to want to do it. And now I see one of my nephews in college, 2 of them, and I see the kind of workload that they have, and I understand why it's hard. It's not the same. I mean, I had a heavy workload, but, I mean, even in high school, my nephew sits for 20 hours doing homework at night, which I think is insane. So in this book, which characters would you say, if you met them in front of you, if somebody saw them in front of, which ones would you say are the most dangerous?
Probably Baz, Jor-El, and Tina Roberts.
Oh. Yeah, they are. You know, too dangerous, I know.
And the reason why I say those two characters was Baz was more like a hitman. He was kind of not really mafioso, but he was a hitman. He was cold and ruthless. Whereas Tina, who, you know, was in love with him, you know, she was a rich, you know, granddaughter, stunning in beauty, a redhead, a fireball. You know, she was tall and everything, and she could shoot somebody sitting at a table and continue to eat her dinner without batting an eye. I mean, she was cold-hearted, you know. So, and I think, you know, those two people were the baddest of the bad in the book. And so when you read the book, you'll see them going through in and out doing different things, and you're just going, how does these people get caught? But then you realize if you're one or two steps ahead and you're always looking over your shoulders, it's hard to get caught.
She was very clever. And you have to get that way. You have to become that way. I can't believe anybody's born that way.
You bring up a funny thing. Are we genetically destined to do things a certain way, or do you learn your traits? Some of people's habits. You can see, you're just like your mom. You're just like your dad.
Yeah.
And some habits, you're going, oh my God, where did that come from? And so it's a,
and how
it's
did
a
that happen? Yeah.
Juggling act. It was a juggling act that I had to balance out, in the book, even though they were really, really bad people, they weren't extremists. They were just cold and calculating.
Like a lot of people are today. No different sometimes. I often wonder about politicians and stuff, and if they have any kind of feeling other than trying to get where they have to go and not really caring about when they get there. Before I forget, because I don't want to forget, next Wednesday I'm starting something new. You have to change it up after a while. Next Wednesday I've got 4 hot and steamy romance writers. I've got Larry Farmer, Doris McCurry, Anne Yost, and the queen of romance, Kathy Barton, on Romance Wednesday at 10. And on Thursday, New York Times bestselling author, internationally famous author, John Land, who I love and adore, Strong Light of Day. And then I have been honored to have been asked on October 29th, because I'm taking a week off, people, to do a special tribute to the memory of one of everybody's favorite witches in America, Samantha Witch, Elizabeth Montgomery, Samantha Stevens, and we're going to do a special 50-year tribute to Bewitched. And that's just October. Herbie Pilato is the author of Twitch Upon a Star, and he asked me to do this personally, and I'm like, oh my God, this is so exciting. It really is. And that's just October. I won't even begin to tell you November. And then Fran's taken off December for other reasons. So when you created the storylines, how did you keep each of them straight? So when you created the plots for each of the companies or each of them, did you create the entire plot at once? Did you create them separately, and each character, did you create their personalities first, or after you wrote them, you put them all together, put it all together?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm still realizing that it was 50 years ago for Bewitched. I'm still trying to figure that one out, how that happened. But getting
back to
my book, it's crazy, where did time go? But what I did when I started to write the book was, I started to have all these ideas, and I realized real quickly, just like in business, I had to have a game plan, a business plan. So I started outline. I got myself a 3-ring notebook and a bunch of blank pages, and I wrote chapter 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 27 or 28, whatever it was. And so I start putting my ideas down. This will be good in 2 more chapters and stuff. So when I came up with ideas, I would just kind of, like on a dartboard, throw the dart and go, okay, that's where it's going to land in the book. So I started to put these ideas down. And then when I got done putting in these ideas, I would start writing the chapters. Well, in the backside of my 3-ring notebook, I did a chapter summary. Because after a while, like you were saying, the book is kind of complex. I forgot, did I say it? I'm going, did I get this mentioned in the book? And every once in a while, I realize, whoops, I forgot to mention this. I got to put this in over here in this chapter and stuff. So I had to do an outline to keep myself honest.
Well, I have graphic organizers as a writing specialist. So there are character ones. There are summary ones, there are plot ones, there's a whole bunch of them. So when I was, before reviewing the book, I said, okay, I'm going to do something different. So I wanted to make sure I got it right. So I took out my Teacher Vision and ABC Teach graphic organizers and printed them out. And I said, this is a great way to even write a book, because I'm writing my first murder. We're almost done. We're getting there. And one of the authors at the Thriller Fest wrote the coloring book of writing a book. And it's really good, because it's got a whole bunch of stuff on how you write different scenes and how you create them. Because I'm good at writing and narratives, but I'm terrible at dialogue. So I'm just learning. So each time I read something and I'm reading your book with the dialogue, I'm saying, oh, that's how you do that. I have no clue, which is great. So how will this story continue? And how did you decide on Enemy in the Heartland? Where did you come up with that title?
Well, the title was kind of, floating around during the time we wrote the book. It was even floating around after, we started to edit. And because the first time I was going to call the book a title, I had Pathways to Heaven. That was the thing that was, in my mind, because, people are going to die, and, we all, are amazed at how this person died, or, why did all those people die? And when people were editing the book or test reading their book, and they're going, really, that doesn't really fit the book. I'm going, why? And they're going, you got a plot going on here that's going to just, destroy, lots of people, we're being attacked, so I'm going, okay. Well, if you look at the book's cover, you see the United States, and you'll see a little line going up there, which is the Mississippi River, to kind of give everybody an idea that that's the central United States, the heartland. So, I'm going, oh, heartland. And then everybody's going, well, we're being attacked. And I'm going, well, the enemy are coming after us, the terrorists. And so, terrorists in the heartland didn't fit, but enemy in the heartland did. So it was about a 3 or 4 month, process of just getting just that title.
Well, the title is everything, by the way. I get a lot of requests for book reviews, people. Too many, like about 40 a day. And I get a lot of summaries, and a lot of times I'll just say I'm not interested, and I don't even, I'll answer the person and just say I'm too busy, or I can't read it, and then they'll send it anyway, so it doesn't really matter. I don't know how they find me, but they do. But when you get a title like Enemy in the Heartland, which is short, it says it all, then of course I'm going to say, okay, I've got to read this, I've got to find out more. So for those of us that are book reviewers, the title sort of says it. Also, if you notice, at the end of my review, I try to incorporate the title to give it a little extra pump. Because if I can't incorporate the title and get what it means, then we're in big trouble. And that usually doesn't happen. Okay, so before we end, in 5 minutes or 10, where can readers find out more about you? And I'm really glad that you included the character list at the beginning of the book, because that made it really simple for me to follow along and like the characters or hate some of them, which is even better. But I really like those two bad guys. I'm sorry, I have to tell you. I am going to be a character in somebody's book. They just told me, and they made me a villain, and I was very happy to say that. That's good. Okay, don't make me too evil, but evil is good.
It's funny because the list of characters is half as long as I originally had it, and my editor said, you better chop that list down because somebody's going to freak out if they see all those characters. You're not going to pick up the book. So I chopped the list of characters down. And the second thing that's funny with the book is people come up to me all the time and they go, is that a fact or fiction book? And I'm going, well, I hope it's fiction, because you don't want to see a lot of dead people around the Midwest. And then the third thing was, people are always going, I want to be in your book, like you just mentioned. So I just go, that's easy, because I'd rather have people say, hey, I want to be in your book, because then I can visualize that person. I don't have to make up a character. So, the only thing I ask them, I'll ask you if you want to be in the next book. Fran,
oh, yes.
You want to be a good... Do you want to be a good guy or a bad guy? Or I should say girl.
I want to be a military guy that gets the bad guys.
Oh, okay.
I want to be the head of an organization.
Okay.
Or
I
could be a research analyst, because I do research and I'm a book reviewer. That might be more credible.
Well, you better give me a good review again on the second book, because your review on Amazon.com was great. You know, because I'll knock you off in the third book if you're not nice to me.
I know.
But
not to worry, we'll give you eight stars instead of five.
Hey, well, thank you. Hey, I like the way you operate. But no, you can find the book on Amazon.com. It's in print form or ebook form, and you know, which amazes me, because since I started to write the book, or I should say the second book, I started to befriend a bunch of best-selling authors that live in Phoenix, because nobody ever teaches you how to write a book or how to get the book to market. And so of my new friends have been showing me some shortcuts and stuff, but what's amazing is how the industry's changed in the last 7 to 8 years, because Phoenix, which is, you know, like 8 million people, had 55 large bookstores in the metropolitan area. You know how many there are now? There's 15. Because Amazon has become such a big bookseller, they're responsible for like 85% of all the books sold around the world. So I made sure I was on Amazon.com, and I've kind of taken my books off the other ones just to focus on Amazon. And then I also have my own website, StephenSwortleyAuthor.com, and on that you can buy a autographed copy. Fran? 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 Hello? Fran?